Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents HBR's 10 Must-Reads for New Managers by Harvard Business Review, Linda A. Hill, Herminia Ibera, Robert B. Cialdini, Daniel Goleman. Narrated by Tom Parks.
Becoming the Boss by Linda A. Hill. Even for the most gifted individuals, the process of becoming a leader is an arduous, albeit rewarding, journey of continuous learning and self-development. The initial test along the path is so fundamental that we often overlook it, becoming a boss for the first time. That's a shame, because the trials involved in this rite of passage have serious consequences for both the individual and the organization. Executives are shaped irrevocably by their first management positions. Decades later, they recall those first months as transformational experiences that forged their leadership philosophies and styles in ways that may continue to haunt and hobble them throughout their careers. Organizations suffer considerable human and financial costs when a person who has been promoted because of strong individual performance and qualifications fails to adjust successfully to management responsibilities. The failures aren't surprising, given the difficulty of the transition. Ask any new manager about the early days of being a boss. Indeed, ask any senior executive to recall how he or she felt as a new manager. If you get an honest answer, you'll hear a tale of disorientation and, for some, overwhelming confusion. The new role didn't feel anything like it was supposed to. It felt too big for any one person to handle. And whatever its scope, it sure didn't seem to have anything to do with leadership. In the words of one new branch manager at a securities firm, "Do you know how hard it is to be the boss when you are so out of control? It's hard to verbalize. It's the feeling you get when you have a child. On day X minus one, you still don't have a child. On day X, all of a sudden you're a mother or a father, and you're supposed to know everything there is to know about taking care of a kid." Given the significance and difficulty of this first leadership test, it's surprising how little attention has been paid to the experiences of new managers and the challenges they face. The shelves are lined with books describing effective and successful leaders. But very few address the challenges of learning to lead, especially for the first-time manager. For the past 15 years or so, I've studied people making major career transitions to management, focusing in particular on the star performer who was promoted to manager. My original ambition was to provide a forum for new managers to speak in their own words about what it means to learn to manage. I initially followed 19 new managers over the course of their first year in an effort to get a rare glimpse into their subjective experience. What did they find most difficult? What did they need to learn? How did they go about learning it? What resources did they rely upon to ease the transition and master their new assignments? Since my original research, which I described in the first edition of Becoming a Manager, published in 1992, I've continued to study the personal transformation involved when someone becomes a boss. I've written case studies about new managers in a variety of functions and industries, and have designed and led new manager leadership programs for companies and not-for-profit organizations. As firms have become leaner and more dynamic, with different units working together to offer integrated products and services, and with companies working with suppliers, customers, and competitors in an array of strategic alliances, new managers have described a transition that gets harder all the time. Let me emphasize that the struggles these new managers face represent the norm, not the exception. These aren't impaired managers operating in dysfunctional organizations. They're ordinary people facing ordinary adjustment problems. The vast majority of them survive the transition and learn to function in their new role. But imagine how much more effective they would be if the transition were less traumatic. To help new managers pass this first leadership test, we need to help them understand the essential nature of their role, what it truly means to be in charge. Most see themselves as managers and leaders. They use the rhetoric of leadership. They certainly feel the burdens of leadership, but they just don't get it. Idea in brief. Ask new managers about their early days as bosses, and you'll hear tales of disorientation, even despair. As Hill points out, most novice bosses don't realize how sharply management differs from individual work. Hampered by misconceptions, they fail the trials involved in this rite of passage. And when they stumble, they jeopardize their careers and inflict staggering costs on their organizations. How to avoid this scenario? Beware of common misconceptions about management. For example, subordinates don't necessarily obey your orders, despite your formal authority over them. You won't have more freedom to make things happen. Instead, you'll feel constrained by organizational interdependencies. And you're responsible not only for maintaining your own operations, but also for initiating positive changes both inside and outside of your areas of responsibility. Armed with realistic expectations, you'll be more likely to survive the transition to management and generate valuable results for your organization. Idea in practice. To succeed as a new manager, Hill suggests replacing myths with realities. Myth: managers wield significant authority and freedom to make things happen. Reality: you are enmeshed in a web of relationships with people who make relentless and conflicting demands on you. To manage effectively, build relationships with people outside your group that your team depends on to do its work. Example: a U.S. media company manager charged with setting up a new venture in Asia initiated regular meetings on regional strategy between executives from both businesses. Myth: managers' power derives from their formal position in the company. Reality: your power comes from your ability to establish credibility with employees, peers, and superiors. To manage effectively, demonstrate character, intending to do the right thing, managerial competence, listening more than talking, and influence, getting others to do the right thing. Example: an investment bank manager won employees' respect by shifting from showing off his technical competence to asking them about their knowledge and ideas. Myth: managers must control their direct reports. Reality: control doesn't equal commitment, and employees don't necessarily always follow orders. To manage effectively, build commitment by empowering employees to achieve the team's goals, not ordering them. Example: instead of demanding that people do things her way, a media manager insisted on clarity about team goals and accountability for agreed-upon objectives. Myth: managers lead their team by building relationships with individual members of the team. Reality: actions directed at one subordinate often negatively affect your other employees' morale or performance. To manage effectively, pay attention to your team's overall performance. Use group-based forums for problem-solving and diagnosis. Treat subordinates in an equitable manner. Example: after granting a special parking spot to a veteran salesman, a move that ruffled other salespeople's feathers, a new sales manager began leading his entire team rather than trying to get along well with each individual. Don't go it alone. Recognize that your boss is likely more tolerant of your questions and mistakes than you might expect. Help your boss develop you. Instead of asking your boss to solve your problems, present ideas for how you would handle a thorny situation and solicit his thoughts on your ideas. Find politically safe sources of coaching and mentoring from peers outside your function or in another organization. Why learning to manage is so hard. One of the first things new managers discover is that their role, by definition a stretch assignment, is even more demanding than they'd anticipated. They are surprised to learn that the skills and methods required for success as an individual contributor and those required for success as a manager are starkly different, and that there is a gap between their current capabilities and the requirements of the new position. In their prior jobs, success depended primarily on their personal expertise and actions. As managers, they are responsible for setting and implementing an agenda for a whole group, something for which their careers as individual performers haven't prepared them. Take the case of Michael Jones, the new securities firm branch manager I just mentioned. The identities of individuals cited in this article have been disguised. Michael had been a broker for 13 years and was a stellar producer, one of the most aggressive and innovative professionals in his region. At his company, new branch managers were generally promoted from the ranks on the basis of individual competence and achievements, so no one was surprised when the regional director asked him to consider a management career. Michael was confident he understood what it took to be an effective manager. In fact, on numerous occasions he had commented that if he had been in charge, he would have been willing and able to fix things and make life better in the branch. After a month in his new role, however, he was feeling moments of intense panic. It was harder than he had imagined to get his ideas implemented. He realized he had given up his security blanket, and there was no turning back. Michael's reaction, although a shock to him, isn't unusual. Learning to lead is a process of learning by doing. It can't be taught in a classroom. It is a craft primarily acquired through on-the-job experiences, especially adverse experiences in which the new manager, working beyond his current capabilities, proceeds by trial and error. Most star individual performers haven't made many mistakes, so this is new for them. Furthermore, few managers are aware, in the stressful, mistake-making moments, that they are learning. The learning occurs incrementally and gradually. As this process slowly progresses, as the new manager unlearns a mindset and habits that have served him over a highly successful early career, a new professional identity emerges. He internalizes new ways of thinking and being, and discovers new ways of measuring success and deriving satisfaction from work. Not surprisingly, this kind of psychological adjustment is taxing. As one new manager notes, "I never knew a promotion could be so painful." Painful and stressful. New managers inevitably ponder two questions: will I like management, and will I be good at management? Of course, there are no immediate answers. They come only with experience. And these two questions are often accompanied by an even more unsettling one: who am I becoming? A new manager's misconceptions. Becoming a boss is difficult, but I don't want to paint an unrelentingly bleak picture. What I have found in my research is that the transition is often harder than it need be because of new managers' misconceptions about their role. Their ideas about what it means to be a manager hold some truth, but because these notions are simplistic and incomplete, they create false expectations that individuals struggle to reconcile with the reality of managerial life. By acknowledging the following misconceptions, some of which rise almost to the level of myth in their new universal acceptance, new managers have a far greater chance of success. Why new managers don't get it. Beginning managers often fail in their new role, at least initially, because they come to it with misconceptions or myths about what it means to be a boss. These myths, because they are simplistic and incomplete, lead new managers to neglect key leadership responsibilities. Defining characteristic of the new role. Myth: authority. Now I will have the freedom to implement my ideas. Reality: interdependency. It's humbling that someone who works for me could get me fired. Source of power. Myth: formal authority. I will finally be on top of the ladder. Reality: everything but. Folks were wary, and you really had to earn it. Desired outcome. Myth, control. I must get compliance from my subordinates. Reality, commitment. Compliance does not equal commitment. Managerial focus. Myth. Managing one-on-one. My role is to build relationships with individual subordinates. Reality. Leading the team. I need to create a culture that will allow the group to fulfill its potential. Key challenge. Myth. Keeping the operation in working order. My job is to make sure the operation runs smoothly. Reality. Making changes that will make the team perform better. I am responsible for initiating changes to enhance the group's performance. Managers wield significant authority. When asked to describe their role, new managers typically focus on the rights and privileges that come with being the boss. They assume the position will give them more authority, and with that, more freedom and autonomy to do what they think is best for the organization. No longer, in the words of one, will they be burdened by the unreasonable demands of others. New managers nursing this assumption face a rude awakening. Instead of gaining new authority, those I have studied describe finding themselves hemmed in by interdependencies. Instead of feeling free, they feel constrained, especially if they were accustomed to the relative independence of a star performer. They are enmeshed in a web of relationships, not only with subordinates, but also with bosses, peers, and others inside and outside the organization, all of whom make relentless and often conflicting demands on them. The resulting daily routine is pressured, hectic, and fragmented. The fact is that you really are not in control of anything, says one new manager. The only time I am in control is when I shut my door, and then I feel I'm not doing the job I'm supposed to be doing, which is being with the people. Another new manager observes, it's humbling that someone who works for me could get me fired. The people most likely to make a new manager's life miserable are those who don't fall under her formal authority. Outside suppliers, for example, or managers in another division. Sally McDonald, a rising star at a chemical company, stepped into a product development position with high hopes, impeccable credentials as an individual performer, a deep appreciation for the company's culture, and even the supposed wisdom gained in a leadership development course. 3 weeks later, she observed grimly, "Becoming a manager is not about becoming a boss. It's about becoming a hostage. There are many terrorists in this organization that want to kidnap me." Until they give up the myth of authority for the reality of negotiating interdependencies, new managers will not be able to lead effectively. As we have seen, this goes beyond managing the team of direct reports and requires managing the context within which the team operates. Unless they identify and build effective relationships with the key people the team depends upon, the team will lack the resources necessary to do its job. Even if new managers appreciate the importance of these relationships, they often ignore or neglect them and focus instead on what seems like the more immediate task of leading those closest to them, their subordinates. When they finally do accept their network builder role, they often feel overwhelmed by its demands. Besides, negotiating with these other parties from a position of relative weakness, for that's often the plight of new managers at the bottom of the hierarchy, gets tiresome. But the dividends of managing the interdependencies are great. While working in business development at a large U.S. media concern, Winona Finch developed a business plan for launching a Latin American edition of the company's U.S. teen magazine. When the project got tentative approval, Finch asked to manage it. She and her team faced a number of obstacles. International projects were not favored by top management, and before getting final funding, Finch would need to secure agreements with regional distributors representing 20% of the Latin American market. not an easy task for an untested publication competing for scarce newsstand space. To control costs, her venture would have to rely on the sales staff of the Spanish-language edition of the company's flagship women's magazine, people who were used to selling a very different kind of product. Winona had served a stint as an acting manager 2 years before, so despite the morass of details she had to deal with in setting up the new venture, she understood the importance of devoting time and attention to managing relationships with her superiors and peers. For example, she compiled biweekly executive notes from her department heads that she circulated to executives at headquarters. To enhance communication with the women's magazine, she initiated regular Latin American board meetings, at which top worldwide executives from both the teen and women's publications could discuss regional strategy. Her prior experience notwithstanding, she faced the typical stresses of a new manager. "It's like you are in final exams 365 days a year," she says. Still, the new edition was launched on schedule and exceeded its business plan forecasts. Authority flows from the manager's position. Don't get me wrong. Despite the interdependencies that constrain them, new managers do wield some power. The problem is that most of them mistakenly believe their power is based on the formal authority that comes with their now lofty, well, relatively speaking, position in the hierarchy. This operating assumption leads many to adopt a hands-on autocratic approach, not because they are eager to exercise their new power over people, but because they believe it is the most effective way to produce results. New managers soon learn, however, that when direct reports are told to do something, they don't necessarily respond. In fact, the more talented the subordinate, the less likely she is to simply follow orders. Some new managers, when pressed, admit that they didn't always listen to their bosses, either. After a few painful experiences, new managers come to the unsettling realization that the source of their power is, according to one, everything but formal authority. That is, authority emerges only as the manager establishes credibility with subordinates, peers, and superiors. "It took me 3 months to realize I had no effect on many of my people," recalls one manager I followed. "It was like I was talking to myself." Many new managers are surprised by how difficult it is to earn people's respect and trust. They are shocked and even insulted that their expertise and track record don't speak for themselves. My research shows that many also aren't aware of the qualities that contribute to credibility. They need to demonstrate their character, the intention to do the right thing. This is of particular importance to subordinates, who tend to analyze every statement and nonverbal gesture for signs of the new boss's motives. Such scrutiny can be unnerving. "I knew I was a good guy, and I kind of expected people to accept me immediately for what I was," says one new manager. "But folks were wary, and you really had to earn it." They need to demonstrate their competence, knowing how to do the right thing. This can be problematic, because new managers initially feel the need to prove their technical knowledge and prowess, the foundations of their success as individual performers. But while evidence of technical competence is important in gaining subordinates' respect, it isn't ultimately the primary area of competence that direct reports are looking for. When Peter Eisenberg took over the management of a trading desk in a global investing bank, he oversaw a group of seasoned senior traders. To establish his credibility, he adopted a hands-on approach, advising traders to close down particular positions or try different trading strategies. The traders pushed back, demanding to know the rationale for each directive. Things got uncomfortable. The traders' responses to their new boss's comments became prickly and terse. One day, Eisenberg, who recognized his lack of knowledge about foreign markets, asked one of the senior people a simple question about pricing. The trader stopped what he was doing for several minutes to explain the issue, and offered to discuss the matter further at the end of the day. Once I stopped talking all the time and began to listen, people on the desk started to educate me about the job, and significantly seemed to question my calls far less, Eisenberg says. The new manager's eagerness to show off his technical competence had undermined his credibility as a manager and leader. His eagerness to jump in and try to solve problems raised implicit questions about his managerial competence. In the trader's eyes, he was becoming a micromanager and a control freak who didn't deserve their respect. Finally, new managers need to demonstrate their influence, the ability to deliver and execute the right thing. There is nothing worse than working for a powerless boss, says a direct report of one new manager I studied. Gaining and wielding influence within the organization is particularly difficult because, as I have noted, new managers are the little bosses of the organization. I was on top of the world when I knew I was finally getting promoted, one new manager says. I felt like I would be on the top of the ladder I had been climbing for years. But then I suddenly felt like I was at the bottom again. Except this time, it's not even clear what the rungs are and where I am climbing to. Once again, we see a new manager fall into the trap of relying too heavily on his formal authority as his source of influence. Instead, he needs to build his influence by creating a web of strong, interdependent relationships based on credibility and trust throughout his team and the entire organization, one strand at a time. Managers must control their direct reports. Most new managers, in part because of insecurity in an unfamiliar role, yearn for compliance from their subordinates. They fear that if they don't establish this early on, their direct reports will walk all over them. As a means of gaining this control, they often rely too much on their formal authority, a technique whose effectiveness is, as we have seen, questionable at best. But even if they are able to achieve some measure of control, whether through formal authority or authority earned over time, they have achieved a false victory. Compliance does not equal commitment. If people aren't committed, they won't take the initiative. And if subordinates aren't taking the initiative, the manager can't delegate effectively. The direct reports won't take the calculated risks that lead to the continuous change and improvement required by today's turbulent business environment. Winona Finch, who led the launch of the Teen magazine in Latin America, knew she faced a business challenge that would require her team's total support. She had, in fact, been awarded the job in part because of her personal style, which her superiors hoped would compensate for her lack of experience in the Latin American market and in managing profit and loss responsibilities. In addition to being known as a clear thinker, she had a warm and personable way with people. During the project, she successfully leveraged these natural abilities in developing her leadership philosophy and style. Instead of relying on formal authority to get what she wanted from her team, she exercised influence by creating a culture of inquiry. The result was an organization in which people felt empowered, committed, and accountable for fulfilling the company's vision. Winona was easygoing and fun, a subordinate says, but she would ask and ask and ask to get to the bottom of something. You would say something to her, she would say it back to you, and that way everyone was 100% clear on what we were talking about. Once she got the information and knew what you were doing, you had to be consistent. She would say, "You told me X, why are you doing Y? I'm confused." Although she was demanding, she didn't demand that people do things her way. Her subordinates were committed to the team's goals because they were empowered, not ordered, to achieve them. The more power managers are willing to share with subordinates in this way, the more influence they tend to command. When they lead in a manner that allows their people to take the initiative, they build their own credibility as managers. Managers must focus on forging good individual relationships. Managing interdependencies and exercising informal authority derived from personal credibility.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?